and at once a blindness came upon him, even upon Gimli Glóin's son, who had walked unafraid in many deep places of the world. Aragorn had brought torches from Dunharrow, and now he went ahead bearing one aloft, and Eladan with another went at the rear, and Gimli, stumbling behind, strove to overtake him. He could see nothing but the dim flame of the torches, but if the company halted, there seemed an endless whisper of voices all about him, a murmur of words in no tongue that he had ever heard before. Nothing assailed the company, nor withstood their passage, and yet steadily fear grew on the dwarf as he went on. Most of all because he knew now that there could be no turning back. All the paths behind were thronged by an unseen host that followed in the dark. So time unreckoned passed, until Gimli saw a sight that he was ever afterwards loath to recall. The road was wide, as far as he could judge, but now the company came suddenly into a great empty space, and there were no longer any walls upon either side. The dread was so heavy on him that he could hardly walk. Away to the left something glittered in the gloom as Aragorn's torch drew near. Then Aragorn halted and went to look what it might be.
"Does he feel no fear?" muttered the dwarf. "In any other cave Gimli Glóin's son would have been the first to run to the gleam of gold, but not here. Let it lie."
Nonetheless he drew near, and saw Aragorn kneeling, while Eladan held aloft both torches. Before him were the bones of a mighty man. He had been clad in mail, and still his harness lay there whole, for the cavern's air was as dry as dust, and his hauberk was gilded. His belt was of gold and garnets, and rich with gold was the helm upon his bony head face downward on the floor. He had fallen near the far wall of the cave, as now could be seen, and before him stood a stony door closed fast. His finger bones were still clawing at the cracks. A notched and broken sword lay by him, as if he had hewn at the rock in his last despair. Aragorn did not touch him, but after gazing silently for a while he rose and sighed.
"Hither shall the flowers of Cymbal Mun come never unto world's end," he murmured. 9 mounds and 7 there are, now green with grass, and through all the long years he has lain at the door that he could not unlock. Whither does it lead? Why would it pass? None shall ever know." "For that is not my errand," he cried, turning back and speaking to the whispering darkness behind. "Keep your hoards and your secrets hidden in the accursed years. Speed only, we ask. Let us pass, and then come. I summon you to the stone of Erech." There was no answer, unless it were an utter silence more dreadful than the whispers before, and then a chill blast came, in which the torches flickered and went out, and could not be rekindled. Of the time that followed, 1 hour or many, Gimli remembered little. The others pressed on, but he was ever hindmost, pursued by a groping horror that seemed always just about to seize him, and a rumour came after him like the shadow sound of many feet. He stumbled on until he was crawling like a beast on the ground, and felt that he could endure no more. He must either find an ending and escape, or run back in madness to meet the following fear. Suddenly he heard the tinkle of water, a sound hard and clear as a stone, falling into a dream of dark shadow. Light grew, and lo! The company passed through another gateway, high-arched and broad, and a rill ran out beside them. And beyond, going steeply down, was a road between sheer cliffs, knife-edged against the sky far above. So deep and narrow was that chasm that the sky was dark, and in it small stars glinted. Yet, as Gimli after learned, it was still 2 hours ere sunset of the day on which they had set out from Dunharrow. Though for all that he could then tell, it might have been twilight in some later year or in some other world. The company now mounted again, and Gimli returned to Legolas. They rode in file, and evening came on, and a deep blue dusk, and still fear pursued them. Legolas, turning to speak to Gimli, looked back, and the dwarf saw before his face the glitter in the elf's bright eyes. Behind them rode Elladan, last of the company, but not the last of those that took the downward road. "The dead are following," said Legolas. "I see shapes of men and of horses, and pale banners like shreds of cloud, and spears like winter thickets on a misty night. The dead are following. Yes, the dead ride behind. They have been summoned," said Elladan. The company came at last out of the ravine, as suddenly as if they had issued from a crack in a wall, and there lay the uplands of a great vale before them, and the streams beside them went down with a cold voice over many falls.
"Where in Middle-earth are we?"
said Gimli, and Elladan answered, "We've descended from the uprising of the Morthond, the long chill river that flows at last to the sea that washes the walls of Dol Amroth. You will not need to ask hereafter how comes its name. Blackroot men call it." The Morthond Vale made a great bay that beat up against the sheer southern faces of the mountains. Its steep slopes were grass-grown, but all was grey in that hour, for the sun had gone, and far below lights twinkled in the homes of men. The vale was rich, and many folk dwelt there. Then, without turning, Aragorn cried aloud, so that all could hear,
"Friends, forget your weariness. Ride now, ride! We must come to the stone of Erech ere this day passes, and long still is the way."
So without looking back they rode the mountain fields until they came to a bridge over the growing torrent and found a road that went down into the land. Lights went out in house and hamlet as they came, and doors were shut, and folk that were afield cried in terror and ran wild like hunted deer. Ever there rose the same cry in the gathering night.
"The King of the Dead! The King of the Dead has come upon us!"
Bells were ringing far below, and all men fled before the face of Aragorn, but the grey company in their haste rode like hunters, until their horses were stumbling with weariness. And thus, just ere midnight, and in a darkness as black as the caverns in the mountains, they came at last to the hills of Erech. Long had the terror of the dead lain upon that hill and upon the empty fields about it. For upon the top stood a black stone, round as a great globe, the height of a man, though its half was buried in the ground. Unearthly it looked, as though it had fallen from the sky, as some believed. But those who remembered still the lore of Westerness told that it had been brought out of the ruin of Numenor and there set by Isildur at his landing. None of the people of the valley dared to approach it, nor would they dwell near, for they said that it was a trysting place of the shadow men, and there they would gather in times of fear, thronging round the stone and whispering. To that stone the company came and halted in the dead of night. Then Elrohir gave to Aragorn a silver horn, and he blew upon it, and it seemed to those that stood near that they heard a sound of answering horns, as if it was an echo in deep caves far away. No other sound they heard, and yet they were aware of a great host gathered all about the hill on which they stood, and a chill wind like the breath of ghosts came down from the mountains. But Aragorn dismounted, and standing by the stone, he cried in a great voice,
"Oathbreakers, why have ye come?"
And a voice was heard out of the night that answered him, as if from far away,
"To fulfill our oath and have peace."
Then Aragorn said,
"The hour has come at last. Now I go to Pelargir upon Anduin, and ye shall come after me. And when all this land is clean of the servants of Sauron, I will hold the oath fulfilled, and ye shall have peace and depart for ever. For I am Elessar, Isildur's heir of Gondor."
And with that he bade Halberd unfurl the great standard which he had brought, and behold, it was black, and if there was any device upon it, it was hidden in the darkness. Then there was silence, and not a whisper nor a sigh was heard again all the night long. The company camped beside the stone, but they slept little, because of the dread of the shadows that hedged them round. But when the dawn came, cold and pale, Aragorn rose at once, and he led the company forth upon the journey of greatest haste and weariness that any of them had known, save he alone, and only his will, held them to go on. No other mortal men could have endured it, none but the Dúnedain of the north, and with them Gimli the dwarf and Legolas of the elves. They passed Tarlang's Neck, and came into Lamadon, and the Shadow Host pressed behind, and fear went on before them, until they came to Calibel upon Kiril, and the sun went down like blood behind Pinath Gelin, away in the west behind them. The township and the fords of Kiril they found deserted, for many men had gone away to war, and all that were left fled to the hills at the rumour of the coming of the King of the Dead. But the next day there came no dawn, and the great company passed on into the darkness of the storm of Mordor, and were lost to mortal sight. But the dead followed them. Chapter 3. The Muster of Rohan. Now all roads were running together to the east to meet the coming of war and the onset of the Shadow. And even as Pippin stood at the great gate of the city, and saw the prince of Dol Amroth ride in with his banners, the king of Rohan came down out of the hills. Day was waning. In the last rays of the sun, the riders cast long, pointed shadows that went on before them. Darkness had already crept beneath the murmuring fir woods that clothed the steep mountainsides. The king rode now slowly at the end of the day. Presently the path turned round a huge bare shoulder of rock, and plunged into the gloom of soft-sighing trees. Down, down they went in a long, winding file. When at last they came to the bottom of the gorge, they found that evening had fallen in the deep places. The sun was gone. Twilight lay upon the waterfalls. All day far below them a leaping stream had run down from the high pass behind, cleaving its narrow way between pine-clad walls, and now through a stony gate it flowed out and passed into a wider vale. The riders followed it, and suddenly Harrowdale lay before them, loud with the noise of waters in the evening. There the white Snowborn, joined by the lesser stream, went rushing, fuming on the stones, down to Edoras and the green hills and the plains. Away to the right at the head of the great dale, the mighty Starkhorn loomed up above its vast buttresses swathed in cloud, but its jagged peak, clothed in everlasting snow, gleamed far above the world, blue-shadowed upon the east, red-stained by the sunset in the west. Merry looked out in wonder upon this strange country, of which he had heard many tales upon their long road. It was a skyless world, in which his eye, through dim gulfs of shadowy air, saw only ever-mounting slopes, great walls of stone behind great walls, and frowning precipices wreathed with mist. He sat for a moment half-dreaming, listening to the noise of water, the whisper of dark trees, the crack of stone, and the vast waiting silence that brooded behind all sound. He loved mountains, or he had loved the thought of them marching on the edge of stories brought from far away, but now he was borne down by the insupportable weight of Middle-earth. He longed to shut out the immensity in a quiet room by a fire. He was very tired, for though they had ridden slowly, they had ridden with very little rest. Hour after hour, for nearly 3 weary days, he had jogged up and down over passes and through long dales and across many streams. Sometimes, where the way was broader, he had ridden at the king's side, not noticing that many of the riders smiled to see the two together, the hobbit on his little shaggy grey pony, and the lord of Rohan on his great white horse. Then he had talked to Théoden, telling him about his home and the doings of the shire folk, or listening in turn to tales of the Mark and of its mighty men of old. But most of the time, especially on this last day, Merry had ridden by himself, just behind the king, saying nothing, and trying to understand the slow, sonorous speech of Rohan that he heard the men behind him using. It was a language in which there seemed to be many words that he knew, though spoken more richly and more strongly than in the Shire. Yet he could not piece the words together. At times some rider would lift up his clear voice in stirring song, and Merry felt his heart leap, though he didn't know what it was about. All the same, he'd been lonely, and never more so than now at the day's end. He wondered where in all this strange world Pippin had got to, and what would become of Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli. Then suddenly, like a cold touch on his heart, he thought of Frodo and Sam. "I'm forgetting them," he said to himself reproachfully, "and yet they're more important than all the rest of us, and I came to help them. But now they must be hundreds of miles away, if they're still alive." He shivered.
"Harrowdale at last," said Éomer. "Our journey is almost at an end." They halted. The paths out of the narrow gorge fell steeply. Only a glimpse, as through a tall window, could be seen of the great valley in the gloaming below. A single small light could be seen twinkling by the river.
"The journey is over, maybe," said Théoden, "but I have far yet to go. Last night the moon was full, and in the morning I shall ride to Edoras to the gathering of the Mark."
"But if you would take my counsel," said Éomer in a low voice, "you would then return hither until the war is over, lost or won."
Théoden smiled.
"Nay, my son, for so I will call you, speak not the soft words of worm-tongue in my old ears." He drew himself up and looked back at the long line of his men fading into the dusk behind. "Long years in the space of days, it seems, since I rode west. But never will I lean on a staff again. If the war is lost, what good will be my hiding in the hills? And if it's won, what grief will it be, even if I fall, spending my last strength? But we will leave this now. Tonight I will lie in the hold of Dunharrow. One evening of peace at least is left us. Let us ride on."
In the deepening dusk they came down into the valley. Here the Snowbourne flowed near to the western walls of the dale, and soon the path led them to a ford, where the shallow waters murmured loudly on the stones. The ford was guarded. As the king approached, many men sprang up out of the shadows of the rocks, and when they saw the king they cried with glad voices, "Théoden King! Théoden King! The King of the Mark returns!" Then one blew a long call on a horn. It echoed in the valley. Other horns answered it, and light shone out across the river. And suddenly there rose a great chorus of trumpets from high above, sounding from some hollow place, as it seemed, that gathered their notes into one voice and sent it rolling and beating on the walls of stone. So the King of the Mark came back victorious out of the west to Dunharrow, beneath the feet of the White Mountains. There he found the remaining strength of his people already assembled, for as soon as his coming was known, captains rode to meet him at the ford, bearing messages from Gandalf. Dúnhéir, chieftain of the folk of Harrowdale, was at their head.
"At dawn 3 days ago, lord," he said, "Shadowfax came like a wind out of the west to Edoras, and Gandalf brought tidings of your victory to gladden our hearts. But he brought also word from you to hasten the gathering of the riders, and then came the winged shadow."
"The winged shadow," said Théoden, "we saw it also, but that was in the dead of night before Gandalf left us."
"Maybe, lord," said Dúnhéir, "yet the same, or another like to it, a flying darkness in the shape of a monstrous bird, passed over Edoras that morning, and all men were shaken with fear. For it stooped upon Meadowseld, and as it came low, almost to the gable, there came a cry that stopped our hearts. Then it was that Gandalf counselled us not to assemble in the fields, but to meet you here in the valley under the mountains. And he bade us to kindle no more lights or fires than barest need asked. So it has been done. Gandalf spoke with great authority. We trust that it is as you would wish. Nought has been seen in Harrowdale of these evil things."
"It is well," said Théoden. "I will ride now to the hold, and there, before I go to rest, I will meet the marshals and captains.
Let them come to me as soon as may be." The road now led eastward, straight across the valley, which was at that point little more than half a mile in width. Flats and meads of rough grass, grey now in the falling night, lay all about, but in front, on the far side of the dale, Medi saw a frowning wall, a last outlier of the great roots of the Starkhorn, cloven by the river in ages past. On all the level spaces there was great concourse of men. Some thronged to the roadside, hailing the king and the riders from the west with glad cries, but stretching away into the darkness behind, there were ordered rows of tents and booths, and lines of picketed horses, and great store of arms, and piled spears bristling like thickets of new-planted trees. Now all the great assembly was falling into shadow, and yet, though the night chill blew cold from the heights, no lanterns glowed, no fires were lit. Watchmen, heavily cloaked, paced to and fro. Medi wondered how many riders there were. He couldn't guess their number in the gathering gloom, but it looked to him like a great army, many thousands strong. While he was peering from side to side, the king's party came up under the looming cliff on the eastern side of the valley, and there suddenly the path began to climb, and Medi looked up in amazement. He was on a road the like of which he had never seen before, a great work of men's hands in years beyond the reach of song. Upward it wound, coiling like a snake, boring its way across the sheer slope of rock. Steep as a stair, it looped backwards and forwards as it climbed. Up it horses could walk, and wains could be slowly hauled, but no enemy could come that way, except out of the air, if it was defended from above. At each turn of the road there were great standing stones that had been carved in the likeness of men, huge and clumsy-limbed, squatting cross-legged, with their stumpy arms folded on fat bellies. Some, in the wearing of the years, had lost all features save the dark holes of their eyes that still stared sadly at the passers-by. The riders hardly glanced at them. The Pukelmen, they called them, and heeded them little. No power or terror was left in them, but Medi gazed at them with wonder and a feeling almost of pity as they loomed up mournfully in the dusk. After a while he looked back and found that he had already climbed some hundreds of feet above the valley, but still far below he could dimly see a winding line of riders crossing the ford and filing along the road toward the camp prepared for them. Only the king and his guard were going up into the hold. At last the king's company came to a sharp brink, and the climbing road passed into a cutting between walls of rock, and so went up a short slope and out onto a wide upland. The Firienfeld, men called it, a green mountain field of grass and heath, high above the deep-delved courses of the Snowbourne, laid upon the lap of the great mountains behind. The Starkhorn southwards, and northwards the saw-toothed mass of Iron Saga, between which there faced the riders the grim black walls of the Drimmerberg, the haunted mountain rising out of steep slopes of sombre pines. Dividing the upland into two, there marched a double line of unshaped standing stones that dwindled into the dusk and vanished in the trees. Those who dared to follow that road soon came to the black Dimholt under Drimmerberg, and the menace of the pillar of stone, and the yawning shadow of the forbidden door. Such was the dark Dunharrow, the work of long-forgotten men. Their name was lost, and no song or legend remembered it. For what purpose they had made this place, as a town or secret temple or a tomb of kings, none could say. Here they laboured in the dark years, before ever a ship came to the western shores, or Gondor of the Dúnedain was built. And now they had vanished, and only the old Pukelmen were left, still sitting at the turnings of the road. Medi stared at the lines of marching stones. They were worn and black. Some were leaning, some were fallen, some cracked or broken. They looked like rows of old and hungry teeth. He wondered what they could be, and he hoped that the king was not going to follow them into the darkness beyond. Then he saw that there were clusters of tents and booths on either side of the stony way. but these were not set near the trees, and seemed rather to huddle away from them towards the brink of the cliff. The greater number were on the right, where the Firienfeld was wider, and on the left there was a smaller camp, in the midst of which stood a tall pavilion. From this side a rider now came out to meet them, and they turned from the road. As they drew near, Merry saw that the rider was a woman with long braided hair gleaming in the twilight. Yet she wore a helm, and was clad to the waist like a warrior, and girded with a sword. "Hail, Lord of the Mark!" she cried. "My heart is glad at your returning."
"And you, Eowyn?" said Théoden. "Is all well with you?"
"All is well," she answered. Yet it seemed to Merry that her voice belied her, and he would have thought that she had been weeping, if that could be believed of one so stern a face. "All is well. It was a weary road for the people to take, torn suddenly from their homes. There were hard words, for it is long since war has driven us from the green fields, but there have been no evil deeds. All is now ordered, as you see, and your lodging is prepared for you, for I have had full tidings of you, and knew the hour of your coming."
"So Aragorn has come, then," said Éomer. "Is he still here?"
"No, he's gone," said Eowyn, turning away and looking at the mountains dark against the east and south.
"Whither did he go?" asked Éomer.
"I don't know," she answered. "He came at night and rode away yestermorn ere the sun had climbed over the mountain tops. He's gone."
"You are grieved, daughter," said Théoden. "What's happened? Tell me, did he speak of that road?"
He pointed away along the darkening lines of stones toward the Dwimmerberg.
"Of the paths of the dead?"
"Yes, lord," said Eowyn. "And he has passed into the shadows from which none have returned. I could not dissuade him. He is gone."
"Then our paths are sundered," said Éomer. "He is lost. We must ride without him, and our hope dwindles."
Slowly they passed through the short heath and upland grass, speaking no more, until they came to the king's pavilion. There Merry found that everything was made ready, and that he himself was not forgotten. A little tent had been pitched for him beside the king's lodging, and there he sat alone, while men passed to and fro, going into the king and taking counsel with him. Night came on, and the half-seen heads of the mountains westward were crowned with stars, but the east was dark and blank. The marching stones faded slowly from sight, but still behind them, blacker than the gloom, brooded the vast, crouching shadow of the Dwimmerberg. "The paths of the dead," he muttered to himself. "The paths of the dead. What does all this mean?"
"They've all left me now. They've all gone to some doom. Gandalf and Pippin to the war in the east, and Sam and Frodo to Mordor, and Strider and Legolas and Gimli to the paths of the dead. But my turn will come soon enough, I suppose. I wonder what they're all talking about, and what the king means to do, for I must go where he goes now."
In the midst of these gloomy thoughts he suddenly remembered that he was very hungry, and he got up to go and see if anyone else in this strange camp felt the same. But at that very moment a trumpet sounded, and a man came summoning him, the king's esquire, to wait at the king's board. In the inner part of the pavilion was a small space, curtained off with broidered hangings and strewn with skins, and there at a small table sat Théoden and Éomer and Eowyn and Dúnhir, lord of Harrowdale. Merry stood beside the king's stool and waited on him, till presently the old man, coming out of deep thought, turned to him and smiled.
"Come, Master Meriadoc," he said, "you shall not stand. You shall sit beside me, as long as I remain in my own lands, and lighten my heart with tales."
Room was made for the hobbit at the king's left hand, but no one called for any tale. There was indeed little speech, and they ate and drank for the most part in silence, until at last, plucking up courage, Merry asked the question that was tormenting him.
"Twice now, lord, I've heard of the paths of the dead," he said. "What are they? And where has Strider, I mean the Lord Aragorn, where has he gone?"
The king sighed,
but no one answered, until at last Eomer spoke.
"We don't know, and our hearts are heavy," he said.
"But as for the paths of the dead, you have yourself walked on their first steps. Nay, I speak no words of ill omen. The road that we have climbed is the approach to the door, yonder in the dim holt. But what lies beyond, no man knows." "No man knows," said Theoden. "Yet ancient legend, now seldom spoken, has somewhat to report. If these old tales speak true, that have come down from father to son in the house of Eol, then the door under Drimmerberg leads to a secret way that goes beneath the mountain to some forgotten end. But none have ever ventured in to search its secrets, since Baldur, son of Brego, passed the door and was never seen among men again. A rash vow he spoke, as he drained the horn at that feast which Brego made to hallow new-built Meduseld, and he came never to the high seat of which he was the heir. Folk say that dead men out of the dark years guard the way, and will suffer no living man to come to their hidden halls, but at whiles they may themselves be seen passing out of the door like shadows, and down the stony road. Then the people of Harrowdale shut fast their doors, and shroud their windows, and are afraid. But the dead come seldom forth, and only at times of great unquiet and coming death. Yet it is said in Harrowdale, said Eowyn in a low voice, that in the moonless nights but little while ago a great host in strange array passed by. Whence they came none knew, but they went up the stony road and vanished into the hill, as if they went to keep a tryst.
Then why is Aragorn gone that way? Asked Merry. Don't you know anything that would explain it?
"Unless he has spoken words to you as his friend, that we have not heard," said Aelmer.
"None now in the land of the living can tell his purpose."
"Greatly changed he seemed to me since I first saw him in the king's house," said Eowyn. "Grimmer, older, fey, I thought him, and like one whom the dead call."
"Maybe he was called," said Theoden, "and my heart tells me that I shall not see him again. Yet he's a kingly man of high destiny, and take comfort in this, daughter, since comfort you seem to need in your grief for this guest.
It's said that when the Aeorlingers came out of the north and passed at length up the Snowbourne, seeking strong places of refuge in time of need, Brego and his son Baldur climbed the stair of the hold, and so came before the door. On the threshold sat an old man, aged beyond guess of years. Tall and kingly he had been, but now he was withered as an old stone. Indeed, for stone they took him, for he moved not, and he said no word, until they sought to pass him by and enter. And then a voice came out of him, as it were out of the ground, and to their amaze it spoke in the western tongue. The way is shut. Then they halted and looked at him, and saw that he lived still, but he didn't look at them. The way is shut, his voice said again. It was made by those who are dead, and the dead keep it until the time comes. The way is shut.
And when will that time be? Said Baldur.
But no answer did he ever get, for the old man died in that hour and fell upon his face, and no other tidings of the ancient dwellers in the mountains of our folk ever learned. Yet maybe at last the time foretold has come, and Aragorn may pass.
But how shall a man discover whether that time be come or no, save by daring the door? Said Eomer. And that way I wouldn't go, though all the hosts of Mordor stood before me, and I were alone and had no other refuge. Alas that a fey mood should fall on a man so great-hearted in this hour of need! Are there not evil things enough abroad, without seeking them under the earth? War is at hand. He paused, for at that moment there was a noise outside, a man's voice crying the name of Theoden, and the challenge of the guard. Presently the captain of the guard thrust aside the curtain.
A man is here, lord, he said. An errand rider of Gondor. He wishes to come before you at once.
Let him come, said Theoden.
A tall man entered, and Merry choked back a cry. For a moment it seemed to him that Boromir was alive again and had returned. Then he saw that it was not so. The man was a stranger, though as like to Boromir as if he were one of his kin, tall and grey-eyed and proud. He was clad as a rider, with a cloak of dark green over a coat of fine mail. On the front of his helm was wrought a small silver star. In his hand he bore a single arrow, black-feathered and barbed with steel, but the point was painted red. He sank on one knee and presented the arrow to Théoden.
"Hail, Lord of the Rohirrim, friend of Gondor," he said. "Here gone I am, errand rider of Denethor, who bring you this token of war. Gondor is in great need. Often the Rohirrim have aided us, but now the Lord Denethor asks for all your strength and all your speed, lest Gondor fall at last."
"The red arrow," said Théoden, holding it, as one who receives a summons long expected and yet dreadful when it comes. His hand trembled. "The red arrow has not been seen in the mark in all my years. Has it indeed come to that? And what does the Lord Denethor reckon that all my strength and all my speed may be?"
"That is best known to yourself, Lord," said Hiergon. "But ere long it may well come to pass that Minas Tirith is surrounded, and unless you have the strength to break a siege of many powers, the Lord Denethor bids me say that he judges that the strong arms of the Rohirrim would be better within his walls than without. But he knows that we are a people who fight rather upon horseback and in the open, and that we are also a scattered people, and time is needed for the gathering of our riders. Is it not true, Hiergon, that the Lord of Minas Tirith knows more than he sets in his message? For we are already at war, as you have seen, and you don't find us all unprepared. Gandalf the Grey has been among us, and even now we are mustering for battle in the east. What the Lord Denethor may know or guess of all these things I can't say," answered Hiergon. "But indeed our case is desperate. My lord does not issue any command to you. He begs you only to remember old friendship and oaths long spoken, and for your own good to do all that you may. It is reported to us that many kings have ridden in from the east to the service of Mordor. From the north to the field of Dagolad there is skirmish and rumour of war. In the south the Haradrim are moving, and fear has fallen on all our coastlands, so that little help will come to us thence. Make haste, for it's before the walls of Minas Tirith that the doom of our time will be decided, and if the tide be not stemmed there, then it will flow over all the fair fields of Rohan, and even in this hold among the hills there shall be no refuge." "Dark tidings," said Théoden, "yet not all unguessed. But say to Denethor that even if Rohan itself felt no peril, still we would come to his aid. But we have suffered much loss in our battles with Saruman the traitor, and we must still think of our frontier to the north and east, as his own tidings make clear. So great a power as the Dark Lord seems now to wield might well contain us in battle before the city, and yet strike with great force across the river away beyond the Gate of Kings. But we will speak no longer counsels of prudence. We will come. The weapon take was set for the morrow. When all is ordered, we will set out. 10,000 spears I might have sent riding over the plain to the dismay of your foes. It will be less now, I fear. For I will not leave my strongholds all unguarded. Yet 6,000 at the least shall ride behind me. For say to Denethor that in this hour the King of the Mark himself will come down to the land of Gondor, though maybe he will not ride back. But it is a long road, and man and beast must reach the end with strength to fight. A week it may be from tomorrow's morn, ere you hear the cry of the sons of Eol coming from the north." "A week," said Hiergon. "If it must be so, it must. But you are like to find only ruined walls in 7 days from now, unless other help unlooked for comes. Still, you may at the least disturb the orcs and swarthy men from their feasting in the White Tower."
"At the least we will do that," said Théoden. "But I myself am new come from battle and long journey, and I will now go to rest."
"Tarry here this night. Then you shall look on the muster of Rohan, and ride away the gladder for the sight, and the swifter for the rest. In the morning, counsels are best, and night changes many thoughts." With that the king stood up, and they all rose. "Go now each to your rest," he said, "and sleep well.
And you, Master Meriadoc, I need no more to-night. But be ready to my call as soon as the sun is risen.
I will be ready, said Merry, even if you bid me ride with you on the paths of the dead.
Speak not words of omen, said the king, for there may be more roads than one that could bear that name. But I didn't say that I would bid you ride with me on any road. Good night.
I won't be left behind, to be called for on return, said Merry. I won't be left, I won't. And repeating this over and over again to himself, he fell asleep at last in his tent. He was wakened by a man shaking him.
Wake up! Wake up, Master Hobbitler!
He cried, and at length Merry came out of deep dreams and sat up with a start. It still seemed very dark, he thought. What's the matter? He asked.
The king calls you.
But the sun has not risen yet, said Merry.
No, and will not rise today, Master Hobbitler, nor ever again, one would think, under this cloud. But time does not stand still, though the sun be lost. Make haste.
Flinging on some clothes, Merry looked outside. The world was darkling. The very air seemed brown, and all things about were black and grey and shadowless. There was a great stillness. No shape of cloud could be seen, unless it were far away westward, where the furthest groping fingers of the great gloom still crawled onwards, and a little light leaked through them. Overhead there hung a heavy roof, sombre and featureless, and light seemed rather to be failing than growing. Merry saw many folk standing, looking up and muttering. All their faces were grey and sad, and some were afraid. With a sinking heart he made his way to the king. Here gone the rider of Gondor was there before him, and beside him stood now another man, like him and dressed alike, but shorter and broader. As Merry entered, he was speaking to the king.
"It comes from Mordor, lord," he said. "It began last night at sunset. From the hills in the east fold of your realm I saw it rise and creep across the sky, and all night as I rode it came behind, eating up the stars. Now the great cloud hangs over all the land between here and the mountains of shadow, and it is deepening. War has already begun."
For a while the king sat silent. At last he spoke. "So we come to it in the end," he said, "the great battle of our time, in which many things shall pass away. But at least there is no longer need for hiding. We will ride the straight way and the open road, and with all our speed. The muster shall begin at once, and wait for none that tarry. Have you good store in Minas Tirith? For if we must ride now in all haste, then we must ride light, with but meal and water enough to last us into a battle."
"We have very great store long prepared," answered Hiagon. "Ride now as light and as swift as you may." "Then call the heralds, Eomer," said Theoden. "Let the riders be marshalled."
Eomer went out, and presently the trumpets rang in the hold and were answered by many others from below, but their voices no longer sounded clear and brave as they had seemed to Merry the night before. Dull they seemed and harsh in the heavy air, braying ominously. The king turned to Merry.
"I am going to war, Master Meriadoc," he said. "In a little while I shall take the road. I release you from my service, but not from my friendship. You shall abide here, and if you will, you shall serve the Lady Eowyn, who will govern the folk in my stead."
But, Lord, Merry stammered, "I offered you my sword. I don't want to be parted from you like this, Theoden King, and as all my friends have gone to the battle, I should be ashamed to stay behind."
"But we ride on horses tall and swift," said Theoden, "and great though your heart be, you cannot ride on such beasts."
"Then tie me on to the back of one, or let me hang on a stirrup or something," said Merry. "It's a long way to run, but run I shall, if I cannot ride, even if I wear my feet off and arrive weeks too late."
Theoden smiled.
"Rather than that I would bear you with me on Snowmane," he said. "But at the least you shall ride with me to Edoras, and look on Meadowselt. For that way I shall go. So far Stibber can bear you. The great race will not begin till we reach the plains."
Then Eowyn rose up.
"Come now, Meriadoc," she said. "I will show you the gear that I have prepared for you." They went out together. "This request only did Aragorn make to me," said Heowyn, as they passed among the tents, "that you should be armed for battle. I have granted it as I could, for my heart tells me that you will need such gear ere the end." Now she led Merry to a booth among the lodges of the king's guard, and there an armourer brought out to her a small helm, and a round shield, and other gear. "No mail have we to fit you," said Eowyn, "nor any time for the forging of such a hauberk. But here is also a stout jerkin of leather, a belt, and a knife. A sword you have." Merry bowed, and the lady showed him the shield, which was like the shield that had been given to Gimli, and it bore on it the device of the white horse. "Take all these things," she said, "and bear them to good fortune. Farewell now, Master Merry Arduk. Yet, maybe, we shall meet again, you and I." So it was that amid a gathering gloom the King of the Mark made ready to lead all his riders on the eastward road. Hearts were heavy, and many quailed in the shadow. But they were a stern people, loyal to their lord, and little weeping or murmuring was heard, even in the camp in the hold where the exiles from Edoras were housed, women and children and old men. Doom hung over them, but they faced it silently. 2 swift hours passed, and now the king sat upon his white horse, glimmering in the half-light. Proud and tall he seemed, though the hair that flowed beneath his high helm was like snow, and many marvelled at him, and took heart to see him unbent and unafraid. There on the wide flats beside the noisy river were marshalled in many companies well nigh 50 hundreds of riders fully armed, and many hundreds of other men with spare horses lightly burdened. A single trumpet sounded. The king raised his hand, and then silently the host of the Mark began to move. Foremost went 12 of the king's household men, riders of renown. Then the king followed with Éomer on his right. He had said farewell to Éowyn above in the hold, and the memory was grievous. But now he turned his mind to the road that lay ahead. Behind him Merry rode on Stibber with the errand riders of Gondor, and behind them again 12 more of the king's household. They passed down the long ranks of waiting men with stern and unmoved faces. But when they had come almost to the end of the line, one looked up, glancing keenly at the hobbit. A young man, Merry thought as he returned the glance, less in height and girth than most. He caught the glint of clear grey eyes, and then he shivered, for it came suddenly to him that it was the face of one without hope who goes in search of death. On down the grey road they went beside the Snowbourne, rushing on its stones. Through the hamlets of Underharrow and Upbourne, where many sad faces of women looked out from dark doors, and so without horn or harp or music of men's voices, the great ride into the east began, with which the songs of Rohan were busy for many long lives of men thereafter.
From dark Dunharrow in the dim morning, with Thane and Captain rode Thangle's son, to Edoras he came, the ancient halls of the Mark Wardens mist enshrouded. Golden timbers were in gloom mantled. Farewell he bade to his free people, hearth and high seat and the hallowed places, where long he had feasted ere the light had faded. Forth rode the king, fear behind him, fate before him, fealty kept he. Oaths he had taken, all fulfilled them, forth rode Theoden. 5 nights and days, east and onward, rode the Eoringers, through fold and fen march and the Firien wood, 6,000 spears to sun-lending, Mundberg the mighty under Mindolwin, sea-king city in the south kingdom, foe beleaguered, fire encircled, doom drove them on. Darkness took them, horse and horseman, hoofbeats afar, sank into silence, so the songs tell us.
It was indeed in deepening gloom that the king came to Edoras, although it was then but noon by the hour. There he halted only a short while, and strengthened his host by some 80 of riders that came late to the wapentake. Now, having eaten, he made ready to set out again, and he wished his esquire a kind farewell. But Merry begged, for the last time, not to be parted from him. "This is no journey for such steeds as Stibber, as I've told you," said Théoden. "And in such a battle as we think to make on the fields of Gondor, what would you do, Master Merry Arduk, sword thane though you be, and greater of heart than of stature?"
"As for that, who can tell?" answered Merry. "But why, lord, did you receive me as sword thane, if not to stay by your side? And I would not have it said of me in song, only that I was always left behind."
"I received you for your safekeeping," answered Théoden, "and also to do as I might bid. None of my riders can bear you as burden. If the battle were before my gates, maybe your deeds would be remembered by the minstrels. But it is 100 leagues and 2 to Mundberg when Denethor is lord. I will say no more." Merry bowed and went away unhappily, and stared at the lines of horsemen. Already the companies were preparing to start. Men were tightening girths, looking to saddles, caressing their horses. Some gazed uneasily at the lowering sky. Unnoticed, a rider came up and spoke softly in the hobbit's ear. "Where will wants not, a way opens, so we say," he whispered, "and so I have found myself." Merry looked up, and saw that it was the young rider whom he had noticed in the morning. "You wish to go whither the Lord of the Mark goes? I see it in your face."
"I do," said Merry.
"Then you shall go with me," said the rider. "I will bear you before me, under my cloak, until we are far afield, and this darkness is yet darker. Such good will should not be denied. Say no more to any man, but come."
"Thank you indeed," said Merry. "Thank you, sir, though I don't know your name."
"Do you not?" said the rider softly. "Then call me Durnhelm." Thus it came to pass that when the king set out, before Durnhelm sat Merry Arduk the hobbit, and the great grey steed Windfola made little of the burden, for Durnhelm was less in weight than many men, though lithe and well-knit in frame. On into the shadow they rode, in the willow thickets where Snowborn flowed into Entwash, 12 leagues east of Edoras, they camped that night. And then on again through the fold, and through the fenmarch, where, to their right, great oak woods climbed on the skirts of the hills under the shades of dark Halifirion by the borders of Gondor. But away to their left the mists lay on the marshes fed by the mouths of Entwash. And as they rode, rumour came of war in the north. Lone men, riding wild, brought word of foes assailing their east borders, of orc hosts marching in the wold of Rohan.
"Ride on, ride on," cried Éomer. "Too late now to turn aside. The fens of Entwash must guard our flank. Haste now we need. Ride on."
And so King Théoden departed from his own realm, and mile by mile the long road wound away, and the beacon hills marched past. Caladhad, Minrimmon, Erelas, Nardal. But their fires were quenched. All the lands were grey and still, and ever the shadow deepened before them, and hope waned in every heart. Chapter 4. The Siege of Gondor. Pippin was roused by Gandalf. Candles were lit in their chamber, for only a dim twilight came through the windows. The air was heavy as with approaching thunder.
"What's the time?" said Pippin, yawning.
"Past the second hour," said Gandalf. "Time to get up and make yourself presentable. You are summoned to the Lord of the City to learn your new duties."
"And will he provide breakfast?"
"No, I have provided it. All that you will get till noon. Food is now doled out by order."
Pippin looked ruefully at the small loaf and, he thought, very inadequate pat of butter which was set out for him, beside a cup of thin milk.
"Why did you bring me here?" he said.
"You know quite well," said Gandalf, "to keep you out of mischief. And if you don't like being here, you can remember that you brought it on yourself."
Pippin said no more.
Before long he was walking with Gandalf once more down the cold corridor to the door of the Tower Hall. There Denethor sat in a grey gloom, like an old patient spider, Pippin thought. He didn't seem to have moved since the day before. He beckoned Gandalf to a seat, but Pippin was left for a while standing unheeded. Presently the old man turned to him.
"Well, Master Peregrine, I hope that you used yesterday to your profit and to your liking, though I fear that the board is barer in this city than you could wish."
Pippin had an uncomfortable feeling that most of what he had said or done was somehow known to the lord of the city, and much was guessed of what he thought as well. He didn't answer.
"What would you do in my service?"
"I thought, sir, that you would tell me my duties."
"I will, when I learn what you are fit for," said Denethor. "But that I shall learn soonest, maybe, if I keep you beside me.
The esquire of my chamber has begged leave to go to the out-garrison, so you shall take his place for a while. You shall wait on me, bear errands, and talk to me, if war and council leave me any leisure."
"Can you sing?"
"Yes," said Pippin.
"Well, yes, well enough for my own people. But we have no songs fit for great halls and evil times, lord. We seldom sing of anything more terrible than wind or rain, and most of my songs are about things that make us laugh, or about food and drink, of course."
"And why should such songs be unfit for my halls, or for such hours as these? We who have lived long under the shadow may surely listen to echoes from a land untroubled by it. Then we may feel that our vigil was not fruitless, though it may have been thankless."
Pippin's heart sank. He didn't relish the idea of singing any song of the Shire to the lord of Minas Tirith, certainly not the comic ones that he knew best. They were too, well, rustic for such an occasion. He was, however, spared the ordeal for the present. He was not commanded to sing. Denethor turned to Gandalf, asking questions about the Rohirrim and their policies, and the position of Éomer, the king's nephew. Pippin marvelled at the amount that the lord seemed to know about a people that lived far away, though it must, he thought, be many years since Denethor himself had ridden abroad. Presently Denethor waved to Pippin, and dismissed him again for a while.
"Go to the armories of the citadel," he said, "and get you there the livery and gear of the tower. It will be ready. It was commanded yesterday. Return when you are clad."
It was as he said, and Pippin soon found himself arrayed in strange garments, all of black and silver. He had a small hauberk, its rings forged of steel, maybe, yet black as jet, and a high-crowned helm with small raven wings on either side, set with a silver star in the centre of the circlet. Above the mail was a short surcoat of black, but broidered on the breast in silver with a token of the tree. His old clothes were folded and put away, but he was permitted to keep the grey cloak of Lorien, though not to wear it when on duty. He looked now, had he known it, verily Ernil y Ferianeth, the prince of the halflings, that folk had called him, but he felt uncomfortable, and the gloom began to weigh on his spirits. It was dark and dim all day. From the sunless dawn until evening the heavy shadow had deepened, and all hearts in the city were oppressed. Far above, a great cloud streamed slowly westward from the black land, devouring light, borne upon a wind of war. But below, the air was still and breathless, as if all the Vale of Anduin waited for the onset of a ruinous storm. About the 11th hour, released at last for a while from service, Pippin came out and went in search of food and drink to cheer his heavy heart and to make his task of waiting more supportable. In the messes he met Beregond again, who had just come from an errand over the Pelennor out to the guard towers upon the causeway. Together they strolled out to the walls, for Pippin felt imprisoned indoors and stifled even in the lofty citadel. Now they sat side by side again, in the embrasure looking eastward, where they had eaten and talked the day before.
It was the sunset hour, but the great pall had now stretched